This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Yeah, run reel 10 again. I think we're duplicating a shot here. And tell Jimmy I want 10 chocolate chip cookies. All right? Medium chips, none too close to the outside. Got it?
That's Leonardo DiCaprio portraying the obsessive-compulsive aviation and film mogul Howard Hughes in a scene from Martin Scorsese's film, The Aviator. My guest Thelma Schoonmaker won her second Oscar for editing the film. Her first Oscar was for editing Scorsese's Raging Bull. She's edited each of his movies since then and is now working with him on a new one. Scorsese's films The Aviator and Casino have just been released on DVD, and there's a new 25th anniversary DVD edition of Raging Bull. This year also marks the centennial of the birth of Thelma Schoonmaker's late husband, the British film director Michael Powell, who made The Red Shoes, Black Narcissus, The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, Peeping Tom, and many other films. She's been attending centennial retrospectives of his work, including one earlier this month at the Cannes Film Festival. I spoke with Thelma Schoonmaker about her life and work. Thelma Schoonmaker, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, you worked with Martin Scorsese on his very first film. I think he was still a student when he made Who's That Knocking on My Door? But then you didn't team up with him again until Raging Bull. Raging Bull's out on DVD. It's one of the landmark films in American filmmaking. How did you end up working with him on Raging Bull, reuniting with him after a period of, 10 years in between?
Right. I wasn't in the union in New York or L.A., and the editor's union, so I couldn't work for Marty when he went to bust into Hollywood. He kept calling me and asking me to come and work with him, but I the union wouldn't let me. So they had very restrictive policies. Then you had to serve long apprenticeships, and then you had to serve another long stretch of time as an assistant before you were allowed to be an editor. And by that time, we had made Woodstock. I was the supervising editor of Woodstock. I had been nominated for an Oscar, and I just didn't feel I had to go back and become an apprentice in order to be able to work for Marty and spend 7 years before I could work for him anyway. So I couldn't do it. And he started working with Marsha Lucas, who was also the wife of George Lucas. And he kept calling me, but every time I couldn't do it. So I worked on documentaries about the American Revolution for WQED in Pittsburgh. I did a little short film for Paul McCartney on his world tour. And finally, on Raging Bull, Marty called me and I said, you know I can't work for you. And he said, well, we got you in the union. And I never asked how, but shortly after that, the union did open up the doors to a more liberal policy.
So to this day, you don't know how we got you in the union?
No. I don't ask.
So did you have any idea what you were in for with Raging Bull, how interesting and complex the editing was going to be?
I had no idea. I had always worked in a rather small independent film environment or on documentaries, which were very critical, by the way, for the editing of Raging Bull, because documentaries teach you how to take unshaped footage and create a story out of it, which I had to do with some of the wonderful improvisations between De Niro and Joe Pesci. So I had no idea what a big major studio film was like. And when I went out to Hollywood, there were assistants and things that I had never experienced before. I had always put my own trims away. And suddenly there was this big sort of studio system, and I post-production system, and I said to Marty, you know, I've never done this kind of thing before. And he said, don't worry, I'll be there with you. I've been through it. So that was good to know. But I had no idea the raw power of the footage that was going to land into my hands. In my Oscar speech, I said it was like having pure gold to work on. And it really was. That film is burned into the screen. The crew, on the other hand, was a bit baffled by the film. They couldn't understand why so much time was being spent on a man who seemed to be so unpleasant. So when I would meet the crew on their way back from shooting, they would say, oh, wait till you see what we shot today. We don't get this at all. But I was seeing in the editing room already how amazing it was. And often Scorsese does not put into his scripts what he has in his head. So when they saw the film put together, they saw it then. They were stunned. But I was seeing it already just so alive in my hands. It was astounding.
Now, you mentioned that you had to do a lot of shaping in the editing room of the improvisatory scenes between De Niro and Joe Pesci. Can you talk a little bit about what the raw footage was like and how you shaped those scenes?
Well, the Joe Pesci had not done much work before in films. He had been in one film, I think, which De Niro saw and brought to show Marty, and that's why they decided to cast him. But De Niro, of course, had done quite a few films by then, and he was wonderfully helpful to Joe Pesci in the improvisations, because he would look over at Marty, and Marty would give him a little look saying, "Do it again." And Bob would start the improvisation over again and again and again until Marty got exactly what he felt he needed out of Joe Pesci's performance. And Pesci is such a fertile improviser, and he and De Niro would just kick each other off. What you want to do in a situation like that, when you have two actors who are going you don't know where, it's not scripted, is to have two cameras shooting at all times, because so you can capture the actors' responses to this new sort of tangent they're going off on. But sometimes in the locations Marty was shooting in the Bronx, in real houses like the ones that Jake LaMotta would have lived in, he couldn't get two cameras in the room. So that was the time when, for me, it was I had to try and figure out a way to take two different sessions of great improvisations, one on camera and one off, and try and make it work together dramatically. The most obvious example of that is the kitchen scene where De Niro is hassling his wife about bringing him a cup of coffee. The babies are crying, and Joe Pesci is trying to get him to agree to fight a fighter that he doesn't want to fight. And Marty based that whole scene on the way his agent used to explain his deals to him in Hollywood. He could never understand the percentage this, the that, the... He could never... And he always used to say, "Tell me again. Tell me again." And so that was what he said to De Niro, and De Niro then kept, you know, not understanding what his brother is telling him and making him repeat it over and over again. It was a wonderful improvisation, but it was very hard to make hang together dramatically. I had a hell of a lot of fun working on it because, again, my documentary background, having been handed large amounts of footage that need to be shaped into a story, helped me immensely.
Why don't we hear that scene? And this is from the new DVD release, the 25th anniversary release of Raging Bull.
"Don't ever do that De Niro bull again. No more deals like that. You hear what I'm saying?
What are you talking about?
What am I talking about? Look at that. 168 pounds.
Stop eating.
What's this with the smart ass? I told you I didn't want to do it in the first place. Didn't I tell you that?
No, you didn't say that. You're the one that told me you could get down to 155 pounds. When I get it, when I pull it out of the air?
I don't know if I'm going to make it down to 155. I'm lucky I make it to 160. And on top of that, you signed me for a fight at 155. And if I don't make the 155, I lose $15,000.
That's right.
Oh, you're supposed to be a manager. You're supposed to know what you're doing.
I did just what I wanted to do.
That's what I'm worried about. You didn't...
You want a title shot?
What are you talking about?
You want a title shot?
What am I in? What am I in, a circus over here? I asked him, he's got more sense about this. What are you doing?
You've been killing yourself for 3 years now, right? There's nobody left for you to fight. Everybody's afraid to fight you. Okay, along comes this kid, De Niro. He don't know any better. He's a young kid, up and coming, and fight anybody. Good, you fight him. Bust his hole. Tear him apart. Right? What are you worried about? What's the biggest thing you got to worry about?
You're worried about the weight.
You worried about the weight?
What are we arguing about for? I just said the weight.
Okay, let's say you lose because of your weight. Are they going to think you're not as tough as you were? You're not the same fighter? Good. They'll match with all those guys they were afraid to match you with before. What happens? You'll kill them. And they got to give you a title shot.
Bring me coffee, please.
Why? There's nobody else. Nobody's left. Who are they going to give it to?
Coffee.
In a minute.
You listening to me?
Please, honey, bring me the coffee.
All right.
Oh.
Yeah, boy, how long are you going to wait?
Are you listening? Now let's say you win. You beat De Niro.
Yeah.
Which you definitely should beat him. Right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They still got to give you a shot at the title. You know why?
Why?
Because the same thing as before. There's nobody left. There ain't nobody around. They got to give you the shot. You understand? If you win, you win. If you lose, you still win. There's no way you can lose. And you'll do it on your own, just the way you wanted to do it, without any help from anybody. You understand? Just get down to 155 pounds, you fat bastard. You stop eating.
A scene from Raging Bull with Joe Pesci and Robert De Niro. My guest, Thelma Schoonmaker, was the editor of Raging Bull. She won an Oscar for her editing on that, and she's worked with Martin Scorsese on every subsequent film that he's made. And by the way, Casino and The Aviator have just come out on DVD. Thelma Schoonmaker, in an improvisatory scene like that, would you ever consult the actors, you know, De Niro and Pesci in this case, and ask them what was going through their minds when they did certain things? Would that be a helpful thing to know?
I didn't need that. It was quite clear in the footage what I should try and get to work. There's one wonderful moment I'll just tell you about in the improvisations where the wife, played by Teresa Saldana of Joe Pesci, tries to defend her sister-in-law and says she didn't mean nothing. And Joe Pesci just turns to her and says, "Who asked you?" It's just one of the great laugh scenes in the film because it's so outrageous. And that was completely an improv. She spoke up, unscripted, and Joe's reaction, the timing of the head turn is so wonderful. The pause before the line is so perfect. Of course, comic lines are built out of beats, you know, the waiting just a moment or two can make the line funnier. My husband always used to say that about silent films. They had almost mathematical counts that the comedians used to do with each other. Gracie Allen, I understand, also used to do that. You wait two beats before you answer, and that makes it funnier.
Of course, you could ruin that in the editing. You could take out those two beats if you wanted to.
Well, you can make an actor sometimes look not as good or make them look even better depending on how you edit their footage. That's why it's such a wonderful job. You get to shape things and build drama, build rhythm, build pacing.
Let's talk about the climactic fight scene in Raging Bull. Martin Scorsese had that pretty thoroughly storyboarded before he shot it.
He did, and we did start out with exactly the way he had storyboarded all these amazing shots, but then we began fooling around with it, and during the process of editing, discovering that, for example, when Vicky puts her head down into her hands, his wife sitting in the audience watching this massacre, when she puts her head down in her hands and then when she picks her head up were key moments to hang the whole construction of the montage around. So things like that that you don't expect occur when you get footage that's been shot, and so you sometimes have to change things a little bit. We did violate the initial structure of the storyboard. We worked on it for a very long time. And we even put one shot in upside down.
But what shot was that? And why did you do it?
It's a shot of the legs, De Niro's legs buckling. It just worked better that way. I don't. And so it was a wonderful montage to work on.
Is that almost subliminal, that shot? I mean, does it go by so quickly that you don't notice it?
Yes, it does. It goes by very quickly. Yeah. He had actually his trainer on his shoulder when he was doing those shots of the knees so that he would actually have that great weight on his shoulders. And it helped him when he was buckling from the pounding he's taking from Sugar Ray. But Marty had wonderful ideas in that film. For example, when the fighter who is beating De Niro to a pulp, Sugar Ray, playing the character Sugar Ray Robinson, can't understand why he won't go down. Of course, Jake LaMotta was famous for never going down. He could take any amount of punishment and never go down. Sugar Ray backs away and tries to figure out what the hell is going on. And Marty had this wonderful shot where the lights dim and complete silence occurs on the track. Our sound editor suggested that to us. He said taking sound away often is much more powerful than bringing it in. So we took the sound away, the lights darken down, and Sugar Ray just stands there breathing like an animal. You hear animal sounds of breathing, which our wonderful sound editor Frank Warner put in. And then he decides to come back in for another attack. And as he does that, the camera ramps back up to normal speed again. And we cut to a smashing shot of the glove hitting De Niro's head. Beautiful directing, beautiful conception.
What's an example of something that you had never tried before, never really thought of before, until editing Raging Bull?
Well, I think the...
Probably everything you've just told us, but
yeah,
come to think of it.
well, it's such a rich film. You know, I when I talk to students, I just put the film on and I start talking about it. There's so much I could talk for 7 years about it, I think. Anyway, I would say that the Scorsese had designed the fight so beautifully. Each fight is different. The size of the ring is different in each fight. Depending on the emotional state of Jake's mind. For example, the first time he knocks down Sugar Ray, which was a great triumph, the ring is large and sweeping and brightly lit. And when he loses a fight on a technical decision, which he can't understand, the ring is filled with smoke and dark and murky. And Scorsese shot it with flames below the lens so that there's a mirage-like feeling, a kind of queasy, nauseous feeling throughout. When De Niro goes and sits down in the corner, there's a rope in front of his eyes so you can't see his face. All these things contribute to this incredible evocation of his befuddlement about why he lost this fight. So Scorsese had such a strong conception for all of these fights, and the footage was so brilliantly shot. You have no idea how hard it is to do extremely difficult camera moves in a ring when you have two fighters and a referee moving around constantly in the ring, and try and be in the ring with them shooting. Extremely difficult. That was Scorsese's commitment from day one. He had looked at every boxing film ever made, and the thing he noticed about most of them is that the camera was outside of the ring, of course, because it's so hard to shoot in. But he wanted to be in the ring, and he almost always is. I don't know how they did these shots. It took 6 weeks to shoot the fights in a studio in California.
Were you on the set during the shooting of Raging Bull? As a rule, do you like to be on the set when Scorsese is shooting?
I tend not to like... I love to go to the set to watch Marty and the actors and the crew, many of whom are old friends. We've worked together on so many films together. But I do find it prejudices my eye. My job, I think, is to sit in dailies with Scorsese every night, and he wants to know my reaction. Do I believe something? Is there something wrong? Is there something I don't understand? And if I go on the set and people say to me, oh, gosh, wait till you see this shot. We just laid 20 feet of track, and we're going to crane up here. And then I don't get the same feeling about it if I see it being made as I do when I see it on the screen.
Let's talk a little bit about The Aviator. Can you talk about the scene that you found most challenging or most interesting to work on in The Aviator?
I loved all the ensemble acting scenes in the nightclubs and the rapid fire patter that Scorsese wanted to have, which was very much like the way scenes were shot those days in Hollywood, a lot of very clever dialogue. The overlapping dialogue was... normally would be considered a problem, but he shot it that way. He wanted everybody to be talking on top of each other as part of the style of the film, and that can be alarming for an editor. Usually actors are not allowed to overlap each other because the editor cannot get in with and make cuts in between the dialogue then. But this worked out amazingly. We only had to loop a couple of lines. So the biggest challenge was the scenes of Howard going mad in his screening room. And that took a long time of living with it, living with different edits. And finally, towards the end, going with a very kinetic, emotional approach to it and just slashing into the footage and picking out of it just what made me feel something for Howard. And putting it together not in a linear way, but just an emotional way. So when that suddenly happened, it was great. Something just clicked, and we knew we were finished with it. But it took a while to arrive at that approach because there was a lot of footage in there of him going mad, and we found we had to condense it to make it work within the body of the film.
Yeah, it was obsessive compulsive, and in this mad scene at the end, I mean, you know, he has to figure out what angle to hold the milk bottle so he doesn't contaminate it. And there's just like spotlight on these milk bottles because you're just kind of seeing it from his point of view, I guess. And he's become so compulsive about germs and everything that there's no longer anything that he can touch or eat. And so did you have like a whole array of different examples of this obsessive compulsive disorder and have to choose between those examples?
Yes, Marty had originally thought he would do a lot of his memos, Hughes's insane memos to his employees. For example, when he was receiving reports from detectives who were following his girlfriends, the detective had to stand at the bottom of the office building, and his reports were winched up on a rope so that his physical presence would not be anywhere near anyone in the building. I mean, it was insane, the kind of things that he would write to his employees. And we had a lot more of those in originally. But we found that within the entire length of the film, we had to cut them down to something very short. But they are amazing. I mean, you could read them forever there. At the same time, he was able to make quite sane business decisions. He was running huge companies, and he was able to do both at the same time. You see in the film that he pulls himself out of his madness in order to defend himself in front of the Senate. That's all very true. There's actual video footage of him there triumphing and turning the tables on the corrupt senator who's opposing him.
What's the give and take like between you and Scorsese when you're in the editing room?
Well, you know, we're almost one mind at this point. Scorsese taught me everything I ever knew about editing when I worked on his first film and in the years after that. I never thought I would become an editor. He was born a director. I'm sure he came out of the womb a director. I've never met anyone more completely a director than him. And so he's taught me everything I know. Our taste is the same, therefore. I know what he likes and what he doesn't like. And if we have a severe disagreement, we screen it one way and ask our friends how they feel about it and then screen it the other way. But that rarely happens. It happened at the end of Raging Bull, because when De Niro is confronting himself in the mirror, Scorsese felt very strongly that it had to be a cold performance. And he and De Niro had laid down 15 takes, each one of them completely valid, each one of them different in warmth or coldness. And Scorsese kept sort of striving to get it colder and colder. And he thought that the take 15 was the best take. And De Niro and I thought maybe a slightly warmer one. And so we screened it both ways. And, of course, Marty was absolutely right. We ended up with the one he wanted. But, frankly, that hardly ever happens. We work very compatibly. We're very different. I'm very optimistic and calm and patient. And Marty is emotional and dramatic. We balance each other. And so we have a lot of fun in the editing room. We joke and talk and share all kinds of things. Our love of Michael Powell's films, for example. And he always has on in the corner of the room Turner Classic Movies with the latest classic movie running silent. And so it doesn't interfere. And every once in a while, we'll look over and he'll say, oh, look at this great shot. Oh, look what this director did here. Or we never have the sound up, by the way. It's all visual. And so this constant infusion of inspiration from other films is always going on in his mind. And I think I have the best job in the world, and I'm sure there are a lot of editors who would like to shoot me so they could have him instead of me.
You mentioned that film, the scene in Raging Bull where De Niro's in front of the movie, and he's practicing a scene from On the Waterfront. He's doing the I Could Have Been a Contender scene. This is what you're talking about, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And you know what? You said that Scorsese wanted to use like the cold version. What I really like about that in the movie is that you could tell that, okay, LaMotta is not exactly a good performer or a good actor. And nor is like...
You didn't like his Shakespeare? Well, Horace, my kingdom for...
And, yes. And nor is empathy going to be his big thing. Like, he may have lived it, but it doesn't mean that he can act it. And I think that's such
right.
an interesting thing for a great actor to play a scene, you know, playing a character who's lived it but can't act it.
That's right. There are so many layers of De Niro doing Marlon Brando doing. I mean, it's
exactly
just,
right.
And of course, now that was a direct suggestion by Michael Powell, by the way.
Really?
When Marty had rediscovered Michael Powell and brought him to America, Michael thought that Mean Streets was one of the greatest movies he'd ever seen, and he demanded of De Niro and Scorsese that they show him all the locations where it had been made. In fact, a good deal of Mean Streets was shot in L.A., but the scenes in the cemetery outside the church, for example, and obviously the festival scenes, the San Gennaro Festival, those were shot in New York, and he demanded to be shown where those locations were. So De Niro and Scorsese were driving him around downtown, and they stopped off at the gym where De Niro was training. De Niro could have fought as a middleweight. I mean, he trained for 2 years to be a boxer. He was unbelievable. And so Scorsese and De Niro were looking at the latest videotapes of some choreography that Marty was working out about the fights. And Michael Powell was standing there watching with him. And he said, you know, there's something wrong about the red gloves. And Marty said, my God, you're right. The movie should be in black and white. And it was that wonderful moment when one director kicks off an idea in another director's head. He didn't say the movie should be black and white. He said there's something wrong with the red gloves, and that just clicked with Marty. And he remembered that he'd always seen all the fight films his father took him to, or on television they were always in black and white, and so something just coalesced in his mind. And then at the end of the film, Michael had read the script, and he said, why are you doing Shakespeare again at the end? You should do something American. You should do something that comes from your own experience. And so they decided to do the On the Waterfront speech. They were going to do Shakespeare.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah.
Here's the scene from Raging Bull that we were just talking about. Jake LaMotta, played by Robert De Niro, is in his dressing room rehearsing in front of a mirror before going on stage.
Some people aren't that lucky. Like the one that Marlon Brando played in On the Waterfront, an up-and-comer who's now a down-and-outer. You remember that scene in the back of the car with his brother Charlie, a small-time racket guy, and it went something like this. It wasn't him, Charlie, it was you. You remember that night at the Garden, you came down my dressing room and you said, kid, this ain't your night. We're going for the price on Wilson. Remember that? This ain't your night. My night. I could have taken Wilson apart that night. So what happens? He gets a title shot outdoors in a ballpark, and what do I get? A one-way ticket to Palookaville. I was never no good after that night, Charlie. It was like a peak you reach, and then it's downhill. It was you, Charlie. You was my brother. You should have looked out for me a little bit. You should have looked out for me just a little bit. You should have taken care of me just a little bit. Instead of making me take them dice for the short end money. You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody. Instead of a bum, which is what I am. Let's face it. It was you, Charlie. It was you, Charlie.
How you doing, Jake?
Everything all right?
Yeah.
Ready?
You got about 5 minutes.
Okay.
Need anything?
Nah.
You sure?
I'm sure.
A scene from Raging Bull. By the way, the guy who comes into the dressing room at the end of that scene is played by Martin Scorsese. When you started working with Scorsese, are there certain touchstone films for him that he wanted you to watch? Films that kind of represented the delirium that a film is capable of achieving or whatever.
Oh, yes. And fortunately, I'm able sometimes to screen with him when he and his wife and friends are looking at films he loves dearly. For example, 8 1/2 is one of the benchmark films for him. The Red Shoes is another. Recently, he showed Ashes and Diamonds, the great film by Andrzej Wajda, Polish filmmaker, to DiCaprio as just sort of reference for the role DiCaprio is playing in our new movie called The Departed. So these screenings with Marty they're almost religious events, because we're all a small group of people are in a room sharing this magnificent film and then spending an hour afterwards talking about it and reveling in it, and it's a really precious experience. For example, when we were cutting Raging Bull, Scorsese was educating me about the films of Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger, because he had just discovered Michael Powell living in complete oblivion. and brought him to the Telluride Film Festival. He had entered Peeping Tom into the New York Film Festival, and it had been a big hit there. And he had paid some money towards the re-release of Peeping Tom in America. So there was also a retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art, and he suggested that I go see certain films there. And one night when I came to work, because we used to work late at night in those days on Raging Bull, we now work during the day, he said to me, I have just seen another great Powell Pressburger film, and I want you to go into the living room instead of working right now and watch this on video. Unfortunately, I had to watch it on video the first time, and that was I Know Where I'm Going. And so that's very typical of the way Marty is with his friends. He's often educating people. That you'll notice that his video archivist is suddenly churning out copies of Powell and Pressburger when an actor is cast in one of our films, and they're given the Powell Pressburger education.
This year marks the centennial of the birth of your late husband, the British film director Michael Powell. And some of his films include The Red Shoes, Black Narcissus, I Know Where I'm Going, The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, A Canterbury Tale, Peeping Tom. There was a tribute to him at the Cannes Film Festival this year, and you've been screening some of his movies in other cities. Did you meet Michael Powell through Scorsese? Scorsese was a huge Michael Powell fan. Michael Powell became a big fan of Scorsese's movies. Is that how you met him?
Yes. Marty not only gave me the best job in the world, but the best husband as well. So I've had all the luck anyone could ever want in their life. When Marty was educating me about the films of Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger, Michael Powell was at Dartmouth College. He had been brought there by David Thompson to be an artist in residence. And he would call the editing room, particularly since he knew we worked late at night. If he was lonely at 10 o'clock or something at night, he would call Marty. And often I spoke to him then. And at one point, Marty said, well, he's coming to dinner. You should meet him. And I fell in love with him immediately, even though there was 30 years difference in our age. He was the most amazing man I had ever met in my life. His love of life was stamped all over his face. He was so unusual in the way he dressed, in the way he spoke. He didn't speak much, but when he spoke, it was quite remarkable what he said. And he came back into the editing room because we were editing in a spare bedroom that Marty had at that point. Raging Bull was being edited in a spare bedroom, and I had racks in the bathtub in the adjoining bathroom. And of course, Michael thought that was hilarious. He'd never seen anything so insane in his life, and he loved it. So he would come back and talk with me a little bit, and then we would talk more on the phone. And when we were nominated for Raging Bull, went out to LA for the Oscars, I went to see him at Zoetrope Studios, the ill-fated, unfortunately, experiment Francis Coppola was trying, independent filmmaking in Hollywood, and Michael was there as an artist in residence. And we started having lunch and then dinner, and then things developed, and then we had to tell Marty.
what was Scorsese's reaction?
Well, he was shocked, and but then he said, that's wonderful, and he loved having Michael around. So for the rest of the time, the 10 precious years I had with Michael, he was with us and advising and reacting to the films, which meant so much to Marty and me. For example, he gave us the ending for After Hours. Many people had... we didn't really have an ending. At the end of After Hours, Griffin Dunne is encased in a Plaster of Paris sculpture, and he's stolen by Cheech and Chong and thrown into a van, and they drive off towards Harlem. And we thought that was a fine ending, but everybody else complained. So some people said, well, he should go off in a balloon, and he should do this, and he should do that. And Michael Powell said, oh, no. He has to go back to hell. He has to go back to the office, which he hates so much. So that's what Marty then shot. He also was very instrumental in getting Goodfellas made, by the way. Scorsese was having a lot of trouble because the studio was concerned about the drugs, which was the major theme of the movie, and they wanted to know if it could be removed. And Scorsese said, no, I can't remove it. That's the whole point of the movie. And so I told Michael about this, and he was very concerned always about Scorsese's artistic integrity and his artistic freedom. Having had his own career savaged by the failure of Peeping Tom with the critics, he was very, very anxious that Marty be allowed to do what he wanted. So he said to me, read me the script. And I did, because he had macular degeneration and he could see, but he couldn't read very well. And I read the script to him, and he said, get Marty on the phone. And And he said, Marty, this is the best script I've read in 20 years. You have to make this movie. So Marty went back in one more time, and he got it made. And unfortunately, Michael never saw it because he fell ill then, and which is too bad because he really had a great deal to do with it getting made.
Thelma Schoonmaker, has being a woman in the movie world ever had an impact one way or another? Because when you started, I mean, you started editing movies, what, in the early 70s or late 60s? And so, you know, there weren't as many women either editing or directing or producing as there are today. So did that make it any more difficult for you to get started?
I was fortunate that I fell into a group of filmmakers, Scorsese, of course, being the most important one at New York University, who were very accepting of my role in the films we were making. I was very lucky, I think. It was a quite unique situation. And it just so happened that I think certain feminine characteristics of patience and discipline and organization were needed at that point, particularly in the editing field, which is why I eventually fell into editing. In the early days when we were making, for example, Marty's movie, Who's That Knocking?, we all were doing everything. We drove the cars with the cameraman on the hood. We pushed the wheelchairs. We ran sound. I even learned how to tie into power sources in basements. And the people who taught me said, always bend your knees, because if you get a jolt, you'll fall down and it'll break the contact. We got the food. We did everything. We didn't shoot and we didn't direct. Michael Wadley was the cameraman and Scorsese was very much the director. But it was just a wonderful collaborative time, and I wish filmmaking were more like that these days, big feature filmmaking. The editing fell to me, I think, mainly because the men were always breaking the film and losing things, and things were completely disorganized. So that's why it began to be my job. But then my collaboration with Scorsese developed, So it worked out so well that I was lucky to get the break to work on all these magnificent films. There are many, many women film editors today, of course, and there were women editors way back in the early days. Cecil B. DeMille's editor was a woman, for example. But I just never felt particularly slotted into a category that way. I just thought of us all as filmmakers, I guess.
So you didn't grow up in the United States. Where did you grow up?
I grew up on the island of Aruba before it was a big tourist spot. My father worked for the Standard Oil Company in the personnel department, and he and my mother met, both Americans, both living in Paris. They met there and married, and my brother was born there, and then we were moved to Algeria just when World War II broke out. And I was born in Algeria but evacuated from there immediately when the North African invasion took place. So we landed on the island of Aruba where there was an oil refinery, and I grew up there in a blissful childhood of coming home from school, throwing off my shoes and running down to the beach every day. Very blissful for us as children, but not for the parents because it was a company town. So it was a part of the island that was owned or rented by the Standard Oil Company. So it was a little hard for them, but it was wonderful. And I grew up in a very cosmopolitan atmosphere. There were people from every nationality working in that refinery: Danes, Australians, Dutch, French, English. And so I grew up as a European, really. And when I came to America when I was 15, it was quite a shock. I felt like I was on Mars. I didn't know anything about rock and roll or football. And I sort of just spent the last 2 years of high school pretty privately. And when I went to Cornell University, then I met a whole bunch of New York City girls, and I was fine because they did the same things I did. But it was quite a shock coming back to the States.
What were your formative film experiences? Did you get to see movies in Aruba? Were there a lot of movies you realized you'd missed out on when you moved to the States?
Certain films did come there. Interestingly enough, I saw The Red Shoes there and was deeply affected by it long before I ever knew anything about Michael Powell. I remember seeing, I was probably about 12, and it was quite an experience. And then later when I came to the States, I saw another Powell Pressburger film called The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp on a wonderful show called Million Dollar Movie, mm-hmm. which Scorsese was watching at the same time, where they showed the same movie 7 times a week. And so Scorsese would study the same movie over and over again until his mother would scream, "Turn that thing off!" And I saw Life and Death of Colonel Blimp there and was terribly moved by it. I remember weeping afterwards. And I wasn't allowed to watch television in the afternoon, which was when the show was on. And my mother, when she would come home from work, would always put her hand on top of the TV set to see if it had been on. But I remember being deeply influenced by that film. But I didn't intend to become a filmmaker. I had no idea I was going to become a filmmaker.
How did you start making movies?
I was, because of my European sort of background, I thought I would become a diplomat. I loved being in, abroad. So I studied Russian language and political science at Cornell University, and then took all the Foreign Service exams and passed them all and got to what they call the stress test, where they try and unsettle you as if you're at a cocktail reception in South Africa, and they ask you difficult questions to see how you would behave as a member of the embassy. And I gave all the wrong answers. I said I thought apartheid was horrible, and they were very upset by this, and they said, "You are going to be really unhappy in the Foreign Service. You can't do that. You have to say what Washington tells you can say until such time as they're ready to make a statement like that." They said, "Why don't you go to the USIA, the United States Information Agency? You'll be happier there." But I didn't want to do that, and I went back to Columbia. I didn't go to Columbia, but I took a night course at Columbia in primitive art, which is one of my interests. And I read in the New York Times an ad saying, "Willing to train assistant film editor," which you never see. Today, you would never see an ad like that. People are hired by word of mouth. Editors recommend people to each other. And so I thought, I don't know what this involves, but I'll check into it. And it was a horrible guy butchering the films of Antonioni and Truffaut and Godard for late night television slots. He would sometimes just take a reel out of Rocco and His Brothers, for example, a film by Visconti. And if it was too long to fit into the slot between 2 a.m. and 4 a.m. or whatever, and I would say to him, "You can't do that." And he said, "Oh, nobody looks at these things." But you know who was looking at them? Marty. So that was so awful. He was a big lush also. I used to have to bring him a quart of whiskey every day, which he drank. But I learned enough about negative cutting and subtitling and a few things that I thought, well, maybe I should look into this. And I saw that NYU was doing just a 6-week summer course. And I thought, well, I can just barely afford that. I'll take that. And they split us up into little teams of 10 each filmmakers. I was working on a horribly boring thing about harness racing. And Scorsese was on another team, of course, doing one of his student films called What's a Nice Girl Like You. And it turned out that someone had cut his negative wrong. They were all students. They didn't know how to do it right. And I knew how to correct it because I had worked for this horrible man. So the professor, Haig Manoogian, wonderful professor, said, "Would you help out Scorsese with this film?" And I went over, and he'd been up for 3 days editing it. And I said, "I'll just run down and tell you. You have to lose 6 frames here and 4 frames there." And we recut the film in the negative. And that was the beginning of my whole new life. If I hadn't gone that summer, he wouldn't have been there the next summer because he was graduating. It was just one of those incredible strokes of fate. Wow. I'm so lucky.
You started editing in the early 60s, and editing has changed a lot since then. I imagine most of your work is digital editing. So I know technically your editing has changed, but does the digital approach to editing, has that fundamentally changed in anything about how you go about shaping a film?
Yes, it does, because I feel I can experiment wildly now with digital editing. I can make a copy of my edit in 1 second by just pushing a button that says copy, and I then slash into that edit, not worrying about the sync of the dialogue or the sync of the music. I turn the scene upside down, put the beginning at the end, and just try anything that kinetically seems worth trying. Sometimes I'll make 4 or 5 different versions of that edit so that when Scorsese comes in, he can look at all these versions and we can discuss them together. Now, on film, I wouldn't have been able to do that. I would have waited till he came in, shown him the edit, then he would have had to walk around for a while I re-edited, undid all the splices, and tried and made a record of how I did the original edit. So it would have, I think, dampened my enthusiasm for wild experimentation. So that's a very good aspect of it. The main thing to remember always is that it's just a tool, that the main thing about editing is living with a film, hopefully being given enough time to live with it, to figure out what it needs, Most editors these days do not get that time. It's quite sad. And Scorsese and I fight like crazy to still retain that time. It's so important to live with a film for 2 or 3 months, and then suddenly you begin to see something and you realize what needs to be done to it. And digital editing is just a tool in that. The actual aesthetic, emotional, and rhythmical solutions for things are the same as they were when people were working on upright moviolas.
Thelma Schoonmaker, thank you for your great movies, and thank you so much for talking with us and for explaining a little bit of how you do what you do. Really appreciate it a lot.
Yeah, it's been wonderful. Thank you.
Thelma Schoonmaker won an Oscar for editing Martin Scorsese's Raging Bull and has worked on each of his movies since then. She won her second Oscar for The Aviator, which is now out on DVD. There's also a new 25th anniversary special edition DVD of Raging Bull and a 10th anniversary DVD of Casino.